It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're taking a trip back to Wisconsin's prehistoric past to learn why Wisconsin dinosaurs may have headed for Wyoming millions of years ago. First, President Biden gave a formal address earlier this afternoon announcing his decision to pull the remaining U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by September 11th of this year.
After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
It's the week in Washington. We'll take a look at several top stories in national politics, including the decision to pause Johnson & Johnson vaccinations, the return of Congress and its priorities, as well as the trial of Derek Chauvin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the president's announcement and his decision to pull the remaining troops out of Afghanistan? Is this something that impacts you personally? Did you serve as part of this two-decade conflict, or have you had a family member, son, or daughter serve? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tolu Olorunipa is a frequent guest here on our Week in Washington segment. He's now national political reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back.
Let's start with that announcement from President Biden on Afghanistan. What are we hearing in reaction around Washington in the little bit of time since he made that announcement?
Well, there has definitely been mixed reactions. We have Republicans and Democrats who have been waiting for the United States to get out of Afghanistan for quite a while. So there is some bipartisan support for this announcement that Joe Biden is going to be pulling all troops out of the country before September 11th, that 20th anniversary. There also has been some pushback. There are some more defense hawks who think that we're leaving too early, who think that our withdrawal from Afghanistan should be based on conditions on the ground, not just an arbitrary date. And Biden is having some negative response from some Democrats and Republicans who are not happy with the idea of pulling out just based on a date and not based on achieving the goals. I don't think there are many officials in Washington or elsewhere who would say that the United States can declare victory in Afghanistan. We are sort of pulling out almost out of exhaustion and because we have been there and it has been our longest war, but not necessarily because we've achieved certain goals or vanquished the Taliban. So I do think that there is some pushback and there are some people who wish that Biden would stay the course a bit longer and allow the troops who are still there to complete their mission. But it seems like Biden has come up to the conclusion that no matter what he hears, either from the Pentagon or from detractors on the Hill, he is ready to do this. He has long been a skeptic of this war. And now that he's president, he does not want to prolong it. He said that he does not want to hand this war over to another president, even as he is the fourth president to oversee this war. He does not want to hand it over to a fifth. So he seems pretty determined to make this ending of the war part of his legacy as president.
This is interesting because it's a point of consistency from former President Trump to President Biden. President Trump had made efforts or at least a lot of statements saying he was going to work to bring troops home from Afghanistan. He had set a deadline, I think May of this year, and got some of the similar response. Some Democrats and Republicans criticizing former President Trump as they are now President Biden. What do you make of that one point of apparent agreement between Presidents Trump and Biden?
Yes, they definitely both agree about the need to get American troops out of Afghanistan. They each did not want to preside over that war. President Trump did leave troops in the country for quite a few years. And, you know, he has been criticized for not having a consistent policy. At the beginning of his term, he increased the number of troops and he was fighting with some of his defense officials and criticizing them publicly over the strategy there, saying they didn't know what they were doing, that he knew more than the generals. So at least on this decision, Biden has more support from within his own party. You don't have Democrats saying that Biden is being inconsistent and not following the lead of the experts in his administration, that he's being, you know, flippant with how to fight this war. it does seem like he has support from at least some Democrats who believe that he's taken this decision with a lot of consultation and with consistency. So that helps him a bit, but they do have both former President Trump and President Biden. They do have a similar sort of emotion towards this war, that they do not want to see it prolonged, and they do not see a easy path to victory or even a possible path to victory at this point. So they're both looking for a way to extract the United States from this war. It seems like Biden is doing it much earlier in his term, and for that reason, he's probably going to get less pushback than Trump, who waited so long, and it seemed almost political that he announced it right as the campaign was heating up and he was facing re-election, and he wanted to be able to say, I'm withdrawing all the troops from Afghanistan as a sort of political statement. So for that reason, Biden is getting somewhat less pushback, but it is still a very politically fraught decision, and any kind of terrorist threat or national security threat that may emanate from the Middle East and specifically Afghanistan, that's going to be something that the Biden administration has to watch very closely, because that could blow back on his administration if it seems like it's a result of a premature withdrawal from this war.
Talking to Tolu Olorunipa from The Washington Post, we're looking at some of the top stories in national news, including the announcement from the president today, a timeline to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11th of this year. Let's bring on a caller now on that topic at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. Once again, the United States has expended tremendous blood and treasure in a forlorn effort that was impossible to win, when our enemy, Osama bin Laden, was hiding in plain sight in one of our allied nations. The Afghans have defeated every army that's been in there since day one. The future of Afghanistan is virtually certain. The Chinese are going to move in there with strategic trade deals and foreign aid and steal it out from the rest of the world.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. And Tom, referring there initially to Osama bin Laden, and President Biden referred to the initial justification for involvement in Afghanistan maybe ending with the death of Osama bin Laden, as Tom was alluding to, not in Afghanistan, but in neighboring Pakistan.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense that Biden has the ability to declare this war over, because the central mission when it comes to taking on Osama bin Laden and eliminating that terrorist threat has been achieved. It was achieved several years ago. And I think Biden will say that he was opposed to, you know, staying much longer after that happened. And I think that's going to be part of his messaging as he moves towards the September 11th anniversary, as he carries out this withdrawal, that he says that not only has the major threat been eliminated, but the United States is a very big and very strong country that can protect itself without having thousands of troops on the ground thousands of miles away. And there are other ways to use intelligence, to use other kinds of defense and national security strategies to protect the homeland without necessarily having to deploy so many troops in a war that has been very costly, as the caller said, that has led to a lot of bloodshed, and that, you know, the taxpayers of this country continue to pay the price for on a daily basis, in terms of not only the health and the mental health of the thousands of soldiers and other service members that were deployed, but also, you know, the opportunity cost of the trillions of dollars that were spent in the Middle East that could have been spent on domestic priorities. And I think it's a bipartisan agreement in Washington that money that has gone out the door was not necessarily well spent overall, and that many lawmakers would rather have a mulligan and would rather have another chance to spend that money on other priorities over the last 20 years.
We're talking to Washington Post national political reporter Tolu Olorunipa. It's the week in Washington. We're looking at some of the top stories in national news. We talked some about the Biden administration's decision on Afghanistan. Coming up, we'll look at some of Chalew's reporting related to the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching that trial closely? Are there lessons you think need to be learned during that trial for policing in America, for dealing with communities facing poverty as well? Toulouse has been looking at George Floyd's hometown, Houston. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about top national news stories with Tolu Olorunipa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be talking about the Derek Chauvin trial for the alleged murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. We'll touch, I think, on the Johnson & Johnson pause as well. Join with your thoughts on those topics, your questions at 800-642-1234. Tolu, you've been following a couple threads in the Derek Chauvin trial and George Floyd's life and death, and one of them took you to George Floyd's hometown, where you're looking for the impact of poverty relief programs. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yes. So we went to George Floyd's old neighborhood in the Third Ward of Houston, one of the poorest neighborhoods in that section of the city, to look at how Joe Biden's anti-poverty legislation and agenda are playing out. We know that Biden passed this $1.9 trillion relief plan, which was heavily focused on trying to alleviate poverty in high poverty areas like George Floyd's old neighborhood. And, you know, Biden has talked a lot about equity and about how George Floyd's death really impacted his legislative agenda and made him want to focus more on, you know, protecting people who are vulnerable, people who were who grow up in very tough circumstances, as George Floyd did. And so we went and spoke to residents and families in this neighborhood to get a sense for how Biden's administration was impacting their lives. So we talked to families who had received some of the $1,400 relief checks, unemployment benefits, housing benefits, and other programs that are essentially designed to give people a leg up and give people a chance to sort of break out of poverty. And for a neighborhood like that, this is the kind of programming that would potentially have a major widespread impact on families across the neighborhood, sort of a multiplicative effect of having pulled multiple families out of poverty and maybe making the neighborhood somewhat an easier place to live and an easier place for children to grow up. So we talked to a lot of families who were saying that they were able to receive some of the benefits. We also saw some of the difficulties that the Biden administration will have in reaching some of its goals, because even though a large number of people did get their relief checks, they face much bigger and much more fundamental issues in their attempts to pull themselves out of poverty. Areas including crime, health issues, education issues that will not be solved by a government check still remain. And we looked at how the Biden administration will really face an uphill task of having a very broad attempt at alleviating poverty in a place where it's been entrenched for so many decades, and how difficult that task will be. And we talked to some Biden administration officials about their goals and how they plan to try to tackle this very, very large problem.
And you also looked at the trial itself and wider issues raised in it as the defense for Derek Chauvin, the officer charged here in the death of George Floyd, the defense raising questions of George Floyd's drug use. And you say it is being brought up in the trial. It looks a little different than in past trials of people who have died in police custody.
Yes, that's right. We definitely expected George Floyd's drug use, his drug abuse problem, to be highlighted by the defense. He was under the influence at the time that he was killed, and the defense has used that issue to say that maybe it was not the police officer who killed George Floyd, but it was a combination of his use of lethal drugs as well as his pre-existing health issues that led to his death, and that also that police were justified in trying to restrain him because they did not know what he might do because he was under the influence of various drugs, including fentanyl and methamphetamines. And we talk about how things have changed in the political landscape, in the society, so that drug issues and drug abuse are not as stigmatized as they once were. And you did not have the defense really openly trying to paint George Floyd as some sort of failed moral character because he had used drugs. And other people who were with George Floyd at the time, his girlfriend, who also admitted to being addicted to opioids, were, you know, treated in much more gentle ways by the defense and were not attacked on the personal level or did not have their credibility attacked based on their drug use. That's different from what we've seen in the past. We have seen the drug use of victims of police violence highlighted by defense attorneys, but usually it's a much more harsh approach and there's much less understanding of what we now know to be an issue that's a health issue, not necessarily a moral failing. So we have seen society change in that way, and we're starting to see that play out over the course of this trial. But to be sure, the trial is definitely focusing on Floyd's use of drugs. The defense is really hanging its hat on that as a way to try to sow reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury to maybe allow this officer to be acquitted. And that is something that we have seen over the past years, that sort of the smearing of victims by highlighting some of their flaws, including their drug use. And that's happening in this trial as well.
Talking to Tolu Olorunipa, national political reporter for The Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories in American news and politics. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Let's take it back to D.C. now. Tolu, we had the news early yesterday that one of the three vaccines approved in the United States, the Johnson & Johnson one-shot vaccine, put on hold over health concerns. We talked about that with a health expert yesterday. Just wanted to ask about what the Biden administration is saying and leading health officials are saying about how this is going to affect the overall vaccine rollout. What kind of things are they saying about that?
Well, they are trying to reassure Americans that this will not affect the rollout or the pace of the rollout or the availability of vaccines, that the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccine are still available and they will continue to be available. And they are essentially saying that the pace will continue without any kind of slowdown. But one thing that we have to all watch is the vaccine hesitancy that may be inspired by this decision to pause the J&J rollout, in part because there are people who are taking a wait-and-see approach who are wondering whether or not other vaccines may have issues as well. And we're already sort of on the fence about whether to take some of these vaccines, and to have the Johnson & Johnson vaccine sort of abruptly pause and to have stories, even though there are a limited number of stories so far, but stories of blood clots and very serious illnesses that may come from taking that vaccine, has really led to questions in the country about whether or not the process behind these vaccines was safe. Now, the Biden administration is trying to reassure the public that everything was handled according to the T, and they're only making this pause out of an abundance of caution, and the prevalence of issues is so low as to be almost minuscule in the grand scheme of things. But they are taking this decision out of an abundance of caution and trying to reassure the public that taking the vaccine, whether from Pfizer or from Moderna, will not lead to any major issues, because there have been tens of millions of people who have taken those vaccines and have not had issues, and that they are still encouraging people to continue to sign up for these vaccines to try to reach herd immunity as quickly as possible as the virus continues to spread in the country at a very high level. Even though we have seen vaccinations increase, we are not seeing a sharp decrease in cases yet. And I think the Biden administration is trying to get there by encouraging Americans to continue to sign up for vaccines and to make sure that vaccines are available in every part of the country where people need them.
Also this week, here comes Congress back out of recess, and President Biden had unveiled his American Jobs Plan, the infrastructure idea, hoping to get some Republican support, also facing the possibility of reusing reconciliation to do it without any Republican support in the Senate. What kind of things are you watching for now that Congress is back on the job when it comes to this ongoing issue, Tolu, of infrastructure?
Yeah, I'm watching very closely to see if any of the Republicans that Biden announced and invited over to the White House over the past couple of days will voice some support for an infrastructure package and what number they put out. I have heard that there are some Republicans that are saying they would be willing to spend a few hundred billion dollars on infrastructure, maybe as high as $800 billion. That's far short of what Biden has proposed, sort of $2.3 or $2.4 trillion in spending. But it may start the process of bipartisanship, or it may close the door to bipartisanship, depending on what the number is, whether or not it's seen as a low ball offer and it causes the Biden administration to walk away and say, we're going to do this with only Democrats through reconciliation. I do ultimately think that that's where we end up, a reconciliation style bill. Anything can happen between now and when the bill is ultimately passed. But if Republicans are able to say that they will bring 10 Republicans on board, which is the number that Biden would need to pass something without using reconciliation, that may get the attention of the White House to say, we can work in a bipartisan way. We can pass something with, yes, all 50 Democrats, but at least 10 Republicans, and do something good for the country, which is to update the infrastructure of the roads and bridges and all of the different products that people use on a daily basis. But it does seem like a far cry for some of these Republicans to sign up with what would be a political win for the Biden administration, and getting 10 of them on board may be extremely difficult. So at this point, it does appear like reconciliation is the path ahead. But in the meantime, we'll have to see what happens with any kind of counteroffer that the Republicans bring on board, and whether or not the Biden administration is ready to play ball.
In just our last minute, Tolu, what else are you watching for over the next week in national news?
There are a ton of different things. I will be watching what's happening with foreign policy, the Biden administration's response to what's happening with Iran will be very closely watched. The Iran deal that President Trump walked away from is in a very fragile state at this moment, and I'll be watching to see what the Biden administration does to rescue that deal. It does appear that the Iranians are close to trying to put some pressure on the Biden administration by moving forward with its nuclear program to kind of put the Biden administration in a box. How they respond will be very closely watched. And then finally, I'll be watching for President Biden's first address to the joint session of Congress, which is taking place at the end of the month. It was just announced. That will be very closely watched as well.
Tolu, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Tolu Olorunipa is a national political reporter for The Washington Post. We talked to him today for our weekly look at several top stories in national news, including President Biden announcing today that all American troops in Afghanistan would pull out by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. We'll look more at that issue, by the way, coming up this Friday afternoon here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's dinosaur time. Researchers have learned that dinosaurs may have traveled much farther than previously thought, including maybe an epic voyage that started here in Wisconsin. We'll take a look at the science. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, State DNR Secretary Preston Cole joins the show for a look at wildfire risks around Wisconsin and for a preview of the summer season at state parks. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, scientists found rocks from Wisconsin many miles to the west in Wyoming. Their best guess as to how those rocks traveled 1,000 miles? Dinosaurs. The researchers hypothesized that sauropods, those were the big, gigantic dinosaurs with the really long necks, swallowed the rocks to help them digest food and then made their way west. We're talking now about new research on, possibly, Wisconsin dinosaurs and taking a trip back to our prehistoric past. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Wisconsin's prehistory, our fossil record here in the state? Have you done some fossil hunting here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Joseph Fredrickson is director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh. Joseph, welcome back to Central Time.
Fantastic to be here, Rob.
Well, I want to start with his research that prompted this. Now, this is not a sure thing. There's some argument about whether this is really the real deal here. But tell us about this idea that we had dinosaurs eat rocks, eat Wisconsin rocks, and take them to Wyoming.
Yeah, so it's actually a really neat study that was done in the Morrison Formation of Wyoming, which is dated to about 150 million years ago. And these are rocks contain fossils of some of the most charismatic dinosaurs around, including Allosaurus, the meat-eating dinosaur, Stegosaurus, and the long-necked dinosaurs, the sauropods that you talked about. Now, the interesting thing about the Morrison Formation is that it's mostly made of mudstones. And occasionally, you're going to come across these really hard, rounded cobbles made of quartzite and other hard rocks that really look out of place. And sometimes it's really difficult to see where those could possibly come from in the local area. Now, way before this study, people have hypothesized that those are actually what are called gastroliths. And gastroliths are stomach stones or stones that animals will eat to help them digest. Dinosaurs, unlike mammals, couldn't actually chew their food and digest it in the same way as, for example, cows could. So we think these sauropods and other dinosaurs would actually swallow these rocks to help grind down that plant material, and that those weird-looking stones in the rocks of the Morrison Formation are actually gastroliths.
Yeah, and this is not uncommon. I understand some birds will do this. They get some rocks down in their gizzards, and birds are just dinosaurs, really, or heavily evolved dinosaurs. So this idea isn't so weird that rocks could be traveling around by dinosaur.
No, it's not weird at all. As you mentioned, birds as well as crocodilians have been found with rocks in their stomachs, which are the closest living relatives to these dinosaurs. And we even have some dinosaurs, fossils that have been found with rocks in the right position to be these gastroliths. So it's really quite possible that those weird rocks were at one time inside a dinosaur.
Okay, but why are we thinking these weird rocks that may have been in a dinosaur ended up Wyoming? Why are we connecting them to Wisconsin?
See, that's really where this paper gets interesting. And it's because those rocks are a distinct texture and they're a distinct color. They're red quartzite. And quartzite is a metamorphic rock that used to be sand or sandstone. And it's become very, very hard. In fact, quartzite is some of the hardest rock in the entire world. Now, the red quartzite is unique because a lot of the quartzites around that area out west aren't that deep red color. Here in Wisconsin, however, we actually have red quartzites that everyone in the state could go visit at Devil's Lake State Park, what we call the Baraboo quartzite. And these quartzites are about 1.65 billion years old. And they get their red color because they actually have hematite or iron in them, which gives them that sort of distinctive color. So researchers for this paper actually looked at zircons inside those quartzite pebbles, the red quartzites in particular, in order to reconstruct an age of those rocks. And they noticed that the age of the isotopes that they studied match up very well with the age of the Baraboo quartzite from right here in Wisconsin, and don't actually match that well with quartzites closer to Wyoming. So they're hypothesizing that those rocks were originally from Wisconsin.
Okay, now did we previously have the notion that you know, some of these big guy dinosaurs would go on a 1,000-mile walkabout?
So we didn't know that they would walk quite that far. That's actually a very long journey, even for a big sauropod dinosaur. There have been studies that have looked at the oxygen isotopes of teeth of sauropod dinosaurs and have come to the conclusion that they may have migrated maybe as much as 300 kilometers or so upland versus lowland. And this may be related to breeding habitat for nesting or in search of food. So this would be actually quite a bit longer ways for that, but it's quite a bit possible. We really don't know a lot about the biology and the behavior of these gigantic creatures. So it's not out of the realm of reality that they could be doing this.
We're talking to Joseph Frederickson from the Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh, looking at Wisconsin's prehistoric past and this new research showing that maybe these big sauropods went from Wisconsin to Wyoming. Evidence maybe in these rocks, these quartzite rocks along the way. And you could join in with your questions about that particular study or about fossils and Wisconsin's prehistory. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Pete is with us in Eau Claire. Pete, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Pete?
I found a piece of petrified wood yesterday.
Cool. Pretty old. Are you a fossil hunter yourself, Pete?
I'm more of an agate guy, but I'm always kind of on the lookout for anything. So it's my first piece that I found in Wisconsin. I found some nice big pieces out in Wyoming around 2012 when I worked out there. But kind of made my day. It's got some good colors in it. It's got some red, which I believe is from the iron. So it was pretty interesting.
Pete, thanks a lot for the call. Is this a common find, Joseph, here in Wisconsin, the petrified wood?
Actually, it's not. Petrified wood is very common out west in places like the Morrison Formation of Jurassic Age or Cretaceous in age. So the time of the dinosaurs, you get a lot of petrified wood in those formations. But surprisingly, in Wisconsin, we actually don't have any rocks from that time period. We're missing the entire Mesozoic era, the time of the dinosaurs, in our fossil record. And that's largely because when the glaciers came through in the last ice age, about 20,000 years ago, they scraped all of the rocks clean off of Wisconsin and only left rocks that are older than about 385 million years ago. And during that time, which we call the Devonian period, there were plants on land, but most of Wisconsin was actually deep underwater, or at least underwater in a warm, shallow seaway. So you'd only get the plants that would actually died and floated out into the water and were later buried. Would you actually find those?
Thanks a lot for that call. And I wanted to ask about our absence of dinosaur fossils here in Wisconsin. Now, as I understand it, for at least some of the dinosaur era, some of Wisconsin would have been land. It wouldn't have just been water. Presumably dinosaurs could have lived here, but if they did, we got nothing to show for it. Is that right?
Exactly. So we do have evidence of Wisconsin being underwater from about 500 million years ago to about 385 million years ago. And then we lose the record. But if we look at states that are neighboring Wisconsin or ones out west, we can see that by the time of the dinosaurs, Wisconsin would have largely been on land, and we would have been situated pretty much between the Appalachian Mountains and the rising Rocky Mountains to the west. And in between that, we would have had some lowland, but it mostly would have been largely flat. So there wouldn't have been a place for there to be burial of fossils. And most of those rocks of the right age from the Jurassic or the Cretaceous largely eroded away before we could have a chance to study them. So we don't have a good record of dinosaurs here in Wisconsin. That's not to say that there aren't any rocks. There have been Cretaceous-aged rocks that have been mixed in with cobbles from the Ice Age that have been found out west in Wisconsin. But so far, really, it's been limited to plant fossils that have been found in those. And so far, no dinosaurs yet.
We're talking to Joseph Fredrickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh, about the history of dinosaurs and why we don't see a lot of dinosaur history here in Wisconsin, though they were probably here. And this new study that says, hey, maybe some of those dinosaurs went from Wisconsin to Wyoming. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Dinosaur enthusiasts, fossil enthusiasts, we want to hear from you. Do you have a question about dinosaurs and the state? Do you have a fossil find to share with us? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Weiss Earth Science Museum Director Joseph Fredrickson. He's telling us what life might have looked like in Wisconsin tens of millions of years ago, looking at new research as well, saying, hey, maybe some big dinosaurs moved from Wisconsin to Wyoming. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Greg calling from Waukesha. Greg, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Greg?
Well, you know, I'm really trying to bend my mind around a dinosaur that size walking 1,000 miles. The other thing that is in my mind, isn't there a mountain range that they'd have to cross? And I don't think they like high elevations where it gets cold.
Interesting questions, Greg. Now, there's a mountain range now. Was there necessarily one there then, Joseph?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, the Rocky Mountains and a lot of the mountains that you have around there were actually formed after the Morrison Formation was deposited in the Cretaceous period. So they could be as much as 60 million years younger than the dinosaurs. So at the time, we would actually have seen fairly flat land between Wyoming and Wisconsin, with most of the highlands being to the west of Wyoming and to the east of Wisconsin. The paper actually does bring in the possibility that there was a river that actually ran between the Appalachians all the way to Wyoming, basically cutting through Wisconsin, and may have actually picked up some of these stones along the way, meaning that these dinosaurs may not have actually had to walk all the way to Wisconsin to get them. They might have been able to pick them up somewhere downstream before that river flowed into Wyoming.
Thanks for that call. I'm going to stick with Wisconsin, though. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Racine. Chris, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a beachcomber, and I have found lots of crinoids and shells that are from that period. However, I found some things that are kind of odd, like something that looks like it would be a hoof, but it's petrified. And a piece of a jawbone and what looks like a petrified knuckle bone, but I can't tell. It's a different size than I would expect to see on anything. So where could I find out? Could I send a picture someplace? Is there someplace that I can find out what these things might be?
Interesting, Chris. Is there a place where, you know, people out there finding things like this, Joseph, could go to identify them?
Bring them to the museum, the Weiser Science Museum. I'm happy to identify them. I'm a paleontologist by trade, and part of what we do for the public is actually identify these really cool finds, because as paleontologists, we can't be everywhere. It's actually much more common for people who have an interest in rock hunting to pick these things up and bring them to us, and who knows, they might be very, very important. As you said, the crinoids are very, very ancient that you'll find on the beaches around Lake Michigan. Some of those date back to around 420 million years ago, well before the dinosaurs. But it sounds like the bones that you have, including the hoof or the knuckle bone, might actually be of the Ice Age, about 20,000 years old or somewhere around there, and could be from some of the animals, the mammals that were walking around here as the glaciers were retreating, not as long ago as some of those other fossils.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Great question, Chris. And I know from visits to geology museums, Joseph, that, well, we don't necessarily have a lot in the way of dinosaur remains here in Wisconsin. Those more recent guys you were talking about, the Ice Age people, we had, mammoths and things like that. Can you talk about where we do have more abundant fossil records in the state?
So our fossil record is the really old stuff and the really young stuff. So the animal fossils begin about 500 million years ago in what we call the Cambrian period. And these will include things like trilobites, but also trackways of some of the first animals to crawl out of the ocean and onto land. Around 385 million years ago in the Devonian period, which is also known as the Age of Fish, we had some really cool animals, including large armored fish swimming around the oceans of Milwaukee. And then we have that gap where we really have a lack of knowledge of what was here. But we picked that back up at the Ice Age about 20,000 years ago. And as you said, we have mammoths. We had mastodons that would have been walking around in our own backyard. But we also had some more interesting creatures, I think, like a giant bear-sized beaver called Castoroides. That was here, as well as the possibility of dire wolves, large saber-toothed cats, and even ground sloths would have been in the area.
We're talking to Joseph Fredrickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW-Oshkosh, looking at Wisconsin's prehistoric history. Our starting point today, this research saying maybe some of these dinosaurs wandered from Wisconsin to Wyoming. You mentioned there the oceans of Milwaukee. And that, you know, that's kind of mind-blowing to think about. Can you talk about how much this spot on Earth we call Wisconsin has changed over the eons.
It has changed tremendously. As I mentioned, the rocks in question of this study from the Baraboo quartzite are 1.65 billion years old. Now, the sand to make that quartzite actually comes from mountains that were actually in northern Wisconsin. And we actually can imagine having a mountain range actually cutting through the state. More recently, when we actually would have some of these animal fossils, like during the Cambrian or Devonian periods, Wisconsin was actually positioned south of the equator, and the entire continent was turned clockwise so that what would be where Lake Michigan is now would actually be to our south. So Wisconsin was actually much warmer back then, and it was actually under a shallow seaway, so warm that we would actually have coral reefs growing in the state.
And there is, I ran across this, and I keep meaning to actually have a guest on to talk about this in specific. There's a geologic era named after Wisconsin, the Wisconsinian or Wisconsinian era or period or something like that. That's all I know. Is that a thing?
Yes, it actually is. So it's a little bit, it's not quite as extensive as an era. It's actually a stage within the last ice age. Essentially, the last ice age, when that last lobe of the glacier came down from Canada, it essentially stopped in its tracks right in the middle of Wisconsin. And that's why we have what's called the Driftless area in the west that looks on a map way different than the rest of Wisconsin does to the east. And it lacks all the features that are created by glaciers, like the lakes that you see dotting all over eastern and northern Wisconsin. And geologists name those time periods in the glaciation cycles based on where you can see the evidence of them best. So previous to the Wisconsin, you have some that were in Illinois and Nebraska and Kansas, which are named for those states respectively. But the last one, and probably the most impressive one, is from Wisconsin.
And Joseph, in our last couple of minutes, I want to get back to dinosaurs in Wisconsin. We can be pretty sure they were here, even though we don't have much in the way of direct evidence. With a study like this showing Wisconsin rocks maybe traveling by dinosaur stomach or gizzard or something, are you hopeful that we can get indirect evidence that could help establish what kind of creatures we had here?
Absolutely. There's really no reason to believe that the dinosaurs that we have in Wyoming wouldn't be the exact same ones that we would find in Wisconsin. There wasn't any clear barrier that was keeping them out. So this study, I think it's really nice because it's a reminder to us of how interconnected just the continent would have been during the Jurassic. And it also helps us here in Wisconsin, feel like we're a part of that fossil record, because there's no Jurassic sediments here in Wisconsin, but at least there's a little part of Wisconsin in the Jurassic sediments.
And briefly, we're living in the COVID era. Joseph, what can we see online right now at the Weiss Museum, whether we're in town or far away, just in our last few moments?
So we are open on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and we have a brand new exhibit called Animals Through Time that talks about the evolution of animals from the pre-Cambrian all the way through the modern record. And that was part of a big donation that was given to us by Bruce Danz, a local collector and physician in the Appleton area. Online, we do have a YouTube page where we're actually updating virtual field trips that go to different parts of the state and show you some of the geologic history. Right now, we have one from Sheridan Park in Cudahy that looks at the glacial record of the hills that you'll see around there, as well as one in Mozanie County looking at Blackberry Hill, which is from the Cambrian period and has evidence of some of those first animals to crawl out of the ocean and leave trackways in the rocks that you can still see today.
Ooh, I'll have to check that out. Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Joseph Fredrickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh, looking at Wisconsin's prehistoric past and a new study looking at maybe some heavy travelers from the dinosaur era here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker joins the show to make the case that college campuses should be more inclusive for conservative voices. and we'll find out about the impact of skipping spring break in an already disrupted school year for many kids. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Milwaukee is celebrating today, mostly virtually, in an annual tradition known as Milwaukee Day. Why is today Milwaukee Day? Well, it's April 14th, or 414, or 414, just like the city's area code. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the annual event started in 2010. This year's event has a lot of virtual offerings, including live streaming band performances, DJ sets, and a yoga class. There's some in-person events as well with social distancing, including an axe-throwing contest, sales with curbside pickup, and a tour of haunted Milwaukee. And as the Journal Sentinel points out, the Brewers and Bucks both play today. Brewers at home against the Cubs, Bucks at Minnesota. Many of the events of Milwaukee Day include fundraisers for local nonprofits and schools. As I pointed out before, Wisconsin area codes are unfair to one part of the state. 414 gives you April 14th. 715 gives you July 15th. 920, you've got September 20th. 608 could have June 8th. The poor 262, last I checked, there is no February 62nd. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.